It's New Letters on the Air. Today, another visit with David Sedaris, the satirical writer whose career took off after he began writing for public radio. Author of the 1997 best-selling memoir, Naked, Sedaris talks about the interesting blend of memory, fact, and fiction in his works.
I do my version of the truth, right, which I would like for people to, I mean, I am telling the truth, but, you know, I embellish so much that people don't believe me, and And really, if I was better, I would cut back a little to make things more believable, but I just can't help myself, I guess.
Stay with us for a conversation with David Sedaris, who talks about his literary influences on this edition of New Letters on the Air. I'm Angela Elam. Though David Sedaris would claim he has the worst voice for radio, his popularity on both National Public Radio and Ira Glass's This American Life has launched his writing career. After the airing of his Santaland Diaries in 1992, in which he tells the hilarious tale of being a Christmas elf at Macy's in New York City, Little Brown and Company decided to publish that work along with several other pieces in the 1994 collection Barrel Fever, Stories and Essays. Since then, Sedaris has published the best-selling book Naked, which is dubbed a memoir, and a Christmas collection called Holidays on Ice. Actually, it's no wonder that David Sedaris should end up on the radio. He began performing his writing in his 20s by reading his diaries to audiences while a student at the Art Institute of Chicago. And he's since written plays, including co-authored works with his sister Amy, who's an actress. His satirical works in Naked often draw from escapades within his family, in which he's the second of six kids who grew up in Raleigh, North Carolina, where his father worked as an engineer for IBM. His comic stories include unlikely subject matter such as his own obsessive-compulsive behavior as a child, a stint as a teenage volunteer in a state psychiatric hospital, and his mother's bout with lung cancer. I talked with David Sedaris about his childhood in the South and the inspirations for his book, Naked.
We moved to North Carolina from New York State. I was in second grade. And at that time, IBM and Westinghouse and had relocated a lot of people. And so we moved down there, and then it was the first time I ever heard the word Yankee or rebel. Because basically, if you win the war, you don't have to think about it anymore. And this was like 1965, and they were still fighting it. I remember we were at the grocery store one time, and my mother was talking to another woman from New York State, and the woman in front of her turned around and said, "I wish y'all would just go back where you came from. I can't even get a girl to come and clean my house for $5 a day anymore." And there was a lot of hostility towards us when we first moved there, which actually was great if you're going to be a writer.
Yeah, definitely. Store up all those memories. You've picked up some of what I consider a very Southern... And I'm from the South, so I feel like I can say this. But this way of seeing the world with all its idiosyncratic oddities and sort of glorifying them or embellishing them in a way that I don't think you would do, say, if you were really from the Midwest or something.
And it's I never thought about it.
Of my prejudices. I always think and when I moved to the Midwest, I felt like if anybody had a crazy aunt, they didn't tell anybody about her. But if you have a crazy aunt down South, you talk about it all the time. I mean, it's just kind of a cultural difference. And I just wondered if you had ever reflected on that.
No, I guess I just really never thought about it.
Do you ever...
One thing I've noticed, like being on the book tour and stuff, and I don't think it's what people really expect at all, but I find people in the South to be less judgmental than people everywhere else. And maybe that's what you're talking, you know, like with the crazy aunt. And I think always, you know, people from other parts of the country think that they would be more judgmental. But, you know, I think perhaps you're right that certain behaviors are celebrated in a way. Like, it's okay to be... I mean, it wasn't okay to be a transsexual, you know, in Raleigh in 1965, but... you know, it was okay to wear a hat made out of Coke cans, you know.
uh, Well, I just, you know, when you think about somebody, say even going back to Flannery O'Connor and some of the characters that she wrote about.
She's my favorite writer of all time. And
oh, really?
I read her stories over and over and over. Really, nobody else can. I don't know that I've ever come across anybody who can write dialect the way that she does. Like, I'm Mona. I is one word, and Mona is the next word. I mean, she had such a great ear for it, so she could write it in a way that you could read it and you could hear it without it being all sloppy. You know, people who don't do it well, it's just all sloppy on the page, and it's just embarrassing. I don't know of anyone who ever did that better, and I love her stuff so much. And then I started reading those scholarly books on her because I thought, well, she can't write anything more, but maybe I can read something on her. And their books were, for the most part, very dry, and I did not believe that she sat down at her typewriter saying, what can I use as a man's symbol, you know, against oppression? She just wasn't. I love her essay, though, about writing in Mystery and Manners, the little speech that she gave. She was asked if she thought writing programs discouraged writers, and she said that, in her opinion, they didn't discourage enough of them. But she had really good advice. Like, they had sent her the student stories to read, and she didn't go by the stories one by one. She was just talking about them as a whole. And one thing she was saying is none of these stories that I'm reading, no one has a place. You know, you've got characters, but they're not tied to any land. They're not in a place. And without that place, they're nothing.
Oh, and she was so good at making you sense the place, making you know place with her characters, I thought.
Well, I kind of I almost envied her. And like Bailey White's another person, she has a place. Mm-hmm. She was born there. She's lived there all her life. Her parents are from there. That is her place. But if you don't have a place, you know, you just got to work with what you have. So if you're transferred and you move to this other community and you're an outsider, then perhaps that's your place. You know, as an observer, you know, on the outside looking in. But still, you've got the place where the story happens. And I don't care whether it's on the moon or in Raleigh, North Carolina, or in Kansas City. The place is so tied up in the characters. And anyway, that's just a great little essay that she wrote. It's so rare to read anything about writing that's actually helpful. I mean, most of it's written by people who write books on how to write, and that's the only thing they've ever written. But her little essay is really, really wonderful. And even if you don't get advice out of it, it's just so good to read. Look, here's Flannery O'Connor giving a speech. Do you know what I mean? If she had... I would read her return address on an envelope and get excited. I would have loved to have heard her. I don't know if they ever recorded her reading a story, but I'd just love to hear her voice.
Yeah. Apparently she had such a thick drawl that it was very... The people, when she went to school in Iowa, they had difficulty understanding what she was saying, you know, when they were... So it kind of reminded me of your roommate, you know, the person in the wheelchair. What was her name again?
Deb.
Peg, how you were the only person who could kind of understand what she was saying. And apparently Flannery's accent was so thick, that's kind of how it was with her. So it would be interesting to actually hear a recording.
And she lived in New York for a while, too.
Yeah.
And she was at Yaddo.
She got around. Now, your family, are your parents both still alive, or are they?
No, my mom died 6 years ago, and my dad, he still lives in Raleigh.
Yeah. I sort of assume that your mother might have died, because in Beryl Fever, even though it's a fictionalized story, it deals with the mother who ends up dying.
The title story.
And I thought, well, I wonder if his mother did die. And but, you know, I have to say you are a brave person to do this, because I don't know if I could... If I could write the kinds of things that you do about my parents and have them read it, does your dad hear you on the radio?
Yeah, he's been such a good sport. You know, I'm going to Raleigh next week, and I thought, well, my dad's going to be there, and I have all these new things I've written. And he's in every one of the stories, and he's kind of a buffoon in every one of the stories. And I thought, I can't do that. I can't go to the town where he lives and then read about him being on, you know, obsessed with my sister's weight, or I got to do something that doesn't involve him at all. So I have 4 days to write something. He's been a very, very good sport. It would just be a parent's. That's the worst thing that could happen to a parent.
Well,
to have
you
their
know,
child be a writer.
He must have a good sense of humor as well.
He was upset when Naked came out. He was upset about my grandmother's portrayal in that book, which is a very accurate portrait of my grandmother.
Is it really?
Oh yes, and
oh
I just
God.
Say, you know, the story does not say she was mean or selfish
no.
or greedy, or it just says that she was completely out of place in Raleigh, North Carolina. And I think he would have preferred to write about, oh, you know, I had the greatest grandmother in the world, and looking back, I wish I had her, you know, with me today. And she was, looking back, she was a good grandmother to have, and I did like her, but I'm not going to write a story about it. I'm going to write a story about what a freak she was.
Yeah. She was out of place even when she was still in upstate New York, it sounded like.
Yeah.
She was just a person from the old world who never quite made it to the new world in some way.
Well, in New York State, there was a, you know, she was still out of place, but there were a lot of other Greeks there, and she had a newsstand, and she moved to Raleigh, and all the grandmothers were like the sensible grandmothers with pantsuits, you know, who would go off and visit caves and stuff. And she just had white hair down to her waist, and she would go and forage in other people's yards for dandelion greens and bring them home and cook them. I mean, we'd get calls that she was picking the sunflower seeds out of the shirk's feeder. She was like a hippie. She was like a Greek hippie, Yule Gibbons mixed with some Socrates thrown in and some... she just didn't fit in at all.
Yeah. Do you think, as far as sense of humor goes, that your sense of humor is most akin to your mother?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because we would always... We were very lucky, I think. You know, there were 6 children and my mom and dad and my father. We'd eat dinner. My father would leave the second dinner was over and go watch TV or whatever. And the rest of us would sit around the table for hours and hours and hours, you know, just trying to make each other laugh, trying to make our mother laugh, basically. You know, because when you have that many children, all you want is attention from... We didn't care about it from our father. We wanted attention from our mother. And I thought that's what everybody did. And in high school, we didn't go out on Saturday nights, because that's when you stay home and you make pizza and you watch, you know, the scary movies on TV. And you would never eat dinner and leave the table. I mean, you wait for dad to leave the table and the fun begins, but you would never do that. And I was shocked when I realized later that what other people did, you know, that they would eat in their rooms, or they would beg to eat in front of the TV, or that they couldn't bear their brothers and sisters. So we were just very lucky that way, I guess. And my mom, you know, she'd tell a story. You'd hear her tell a story on the phone, and then you'd hear it 20 minutes later, and it changed. And then you'd hear it an hour later. And, you know, she was like me in that she repeats stuff a lot. And by the end of the day, you wouldn't even recognize the story, but it was a good story. And so
she had honed it.
Right, and she would do the same to us. You know, if you were talking about school, she would say, "You lost me about 10 minutes ago. You know, that is really a boring story. And I don't blame those people for not liking you." You know, if that's the way you're going to tell a story. So our family's pretty much divided at this point. Half of us make money talking about our problems, and the other half pay money to talk about their problems, you know? I mean, I think it's basically the same thing. I mean, you're talking about your past or whatever, and you can either pay a psychiatrist all that money, or you can get an audience together and earn some money doing the exact same thing. And I think it's actually more therapeutic to be on the earning side of the equation.
Well, there's a little section in here. It's a scene with your mom. From True Detective, which is part of the book Naked by David Sedaris, who is also author of Barrel Fever.
This is a story called True Detective, and there were a series of crimes that went on in my family when I was growing up. And at the same time, I had an infatuation with that show, The Fugitive. And, you know, they would say on the TV show he changed his name and his identity. And what he had done was he had changed his identity by putting shoe polish on his hair. So I thought I'd give it a try and try to solve some of these crimes. Later that month, someone went through my father's top drawer, stealing a knee sock packed with 112 Liberty silver dollars. I knew my father's drawers as well as I knew my own. Everyone did. That was how you occupied your time when you had the house to yourself. You rifled through my father's drawers before moving on to his second hiding place in the shed. I had seen and counted these coins many times. We all had. But who would go so far as to steal them? My father gathered us all in the dining room and listened as we each took turns denying any involvement. Dollars come in silver? I never knew that. Does the government issue them in a knee sock, or was that your idea? Okay, my father said, all right, I understand now. Nobody took my coins. I guess he just got tired of living cooped up in that dresser and decided to roll out the door and spend themselves on candy and magazines. That's what happened, isn't it? Oh, they're probably out there as we speak, having themselves a grand old time, aren't they? His voice visited its highest register, and he rubbed his hands together as if he were considering a tray of rich desserts. Free at last, with their whole lives ahead of them. Can't you just feel the excitement? Doesn't it make you want to throw up your hands and scream? He lowered his voice and delivered a series of ultimatums I didn't quite catch. My mind was snagged on the thought of those jubilant silver dollars, raucous and dizzy with their first feelings of independence. I pictured them splitting into groups and traveling by night to avoid any excess attention. It might prove difficult to roll over grass and leaves, so I imagined them huddled in the carport, deciding it was best to stick to the roads and sidewalks. The thought of it made me laugh, and when I did, my father said, "You think this is funny? You getting a chuckle out of this, are you? I'm glad you find it so amusing. Let's see how funny it is when I search your room, funny guy." On television, a search warrant guaranteed that your home would be trashed, and this was no different. Mine was the only clean room in the entire house. This was my shrine, my temple, and I watched in horror as my drawers were emptied and my closets brutally divorced of order. While searching my desk, my father came across a gold-plated mechanical pencil he recognized as his own. It had once occupied the same drawer as his coins, and I admitted that, yes, I had taken the pencil, but I hadn't really stolen it. There was a big difference between the two. You steal the things that you covet, while you take the things the original owner is incapable of appreciating. The pencil had spoken to me of its neglect, and I had offered to put it to good use. Taking is just borrowing without the formality. I'd planned on returning it once it ran out of lead. What was the big deal? This wasn't the sort of case-busting clue he was making it out to be. There were no blaring trumpets or high-speed chases, just a lousy pencil I'd used to make myself feel more important. The moment my father and his pencil were reunited, I became the prime suspect, tried and convicted on circumstantial evidence. There was nothing I could say to change his mind. "Did you spend the money already, or have you got it buried out in the yard?" my sister Lisa asked. Buried. Now I was a thief and a pirate. Falsely convicted of a crime I did not commit, there was only one thing I could do. The shoe polish was kept in the linen closet. I chose black, massaging it into my scalp in an attempt to change my identity. The fugitive's hair always looked perfectly natural. It blew in the breeze created by oncoming trucks as he stood beside the lonesome road, bidding farewell to a town unable to appreciate his unique gifts. My natural hair looked pretty much the same, but once the polish dried, my hair hardened into a stiff, unified mass that covered my head like a helmet. I went to bed and woke to find my sheets and pillows smudged and ruined. My face and arms were bruised-looking, and everything stank with the rigid, military odor of a buffing rag. It was no wonder the fugitive was a loner. I liked the sheen and color of my hair, but found I needed to slick it back to maintain a clear forehead. This hair of mine was bulletproof. You could have pounded on my head with a golf club and I wouldn't have felt a thing. I carried my soiled sheets into the woods, knowing that from here on out, things were going to be different. I'd crossed over the edge, and there was no turning back. After I changed my identity, my next step was to find the real thief and clear my name. My mother and sisters were fond of saying, "The criminal always returns to the scene of the crime." This was some bit of dime store wisdom picked up from one of their television programs, but I thought it might be worth a try. Figuring the thief had good reason to return for more, I undertook a stakeout. My father's closet had shuttered, louvered doors that afforded a view of the entire room. I took my place, waiting a full hour before my mother entered the room, shouting, "I don't give a tinker's damn what they do on Mount Olympus. In this house, you don't boil a $7 steak." My intuition told me that she was talking to my grandmother. Slamming the door behind her, she took a seat on the edge of the unmade bed. She stared down at her bare feet, and then, as if she expected them to apologize for some trouble they'd recently caused, she said, "Well, what have we got to say for ourselves?" She picked at her toenail for a moment before crossing the room to fetch a bottle of glossy polish from the top of her dresser. This was a new shade, the color of putty. Rather than highlighting the nails, it caused them to disappear into the surrounding flesh, creating a look both freakish and popular. I'd never understood why women bothered painting their toenails, especially my mother, whose crusty, misshapen talons resembled the shattered, nugget-sized Fritos found huddled at the bottom of the bag. She stood at the mirror, shaking the bottle and fretting at the sight of her brittle, frosted hair, arranged into a listless style she referred to as the devil's stomping ground. I watched then as she rummaged through her closet, returning with a tall plastic box secured with the sort of latches you might find on a suitcase. I'd been through my father's closet thousands of times, but never my mother's. "If I had something of value, this is the last place I'd put it," she'd say. "The damn moths don't even want what I've got." My father's closet and dresser drawers offered clues to his inner life. I enjoyed uncovering what I thought to be his secrets, but felt it best to honor my mother's privacy, not out of respect so much as out of fear. I didn't want any possible handcuffs or hooded leather mask interfering with the notion that this woman was first and foremost my mother. She carried the box to her dresser and unfastened the latches, lifting the lid to reveal a pale styrofoam head supporting a sandy blonde wig, the hair sculpted into a series of cresting waves. This was a magnificent crown of hair, so perfect that it might have been styled by God himself on one of those off days when he was feeling creative rather than vengeful. After carefully removing the pins, my mother placed the wig upon her head and studied herself in the mirror. She nodded her head this way and that, but the curls, defying all laws of physics, held their position. Fumes from the shoe polish were making me nauseous, and I had begun to perspire, the inky sweat running down my forehead and staining my shirt. "What do you say to that, missy?" my mother asked herself. She applied a coat of lipstick and brought her face close to the mirror, cocking her head and arching her eyebrows in a series of expressions that conveyed everything from heartfelt concern to full-throttle rage. Then she stepped away from the mirror, reintroducing herself slowly, as if her reflection were a guest she was meeting for the first time. I often did the same thing myself in the privacy of the bathroom. "Who's he?" I'd ask, admiring myself with a new shirt or haircut. Most often, my private sessions would end with my pants in a tangle around my ankles. Would my mother now unbutton her blouse? Would she lift her skirt and excite herself? At what point would I call out and put an end to this? How could I live with myself knowing what she looked like naked? "Please," I thought, "don't do it. Don't be like me."
David Sedaris, reading a scene from his memoir, Naked, published in 1997 by Little Brown & Company. If you'd like to hear the other half of this 1998 interview, which we broadcast earlier, you can purchase a cassette copy of both shows. Just give us a call at 888-548-9898. 2477. You can also request a free catalog of our last 20 years of programming. That toll-free number again is 888-LIT-AIRS. Or if you're in Kansas City, please call 235-1159. We also enjoy your letters. Send them to New Letters on the Air, 5101 Rock Hill Road, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. Our email address is newletters@art.net. And let us know the call letters of your public radio station. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters, the quarterly magazine of fine writing published by the University of Missouri at Kansas City. Thanks to the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency, for partial financial support, and to Margaret Smith, Laura Spencer, and Jeremy Kate for their production help. I'm Angela Elam, and thanks to you for listening to New Letters on the Air. I'm Angela Elam. Join us for the next edition of New Letters on the Air for an interview with fiction writer Tim O'Brien, who's best known for his award-winning novels based on his Vietnam experience. However, his new book, Tomcat in Love, takes place on a different battleground, that of the war between the sexes, with a chauvinistic main character that made interviewer Karen Ruzicka ask if anyone had been offended by his comic novel.
Books are any good, I think, are supposed to go to, you know, the raw parts of the human spirit and psyche, our fears and our terrors and our wishes and all the things that make us human. And oftentimes the, you know, books will hit a ragged nerve in a person. But that's what literature is supposed to do.
Find out more about Tim O'Brien and Tomcat in Love on the next edition of New Letters on the Air.